Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die. NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
So everyone should see a message pop up that this meeting is being recorded. And I'll hand it over to you, Michelle.
Awesome. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see you all. I am calling this meeting to order at 2:04 p.m. of the African Heritage Reparation Assembly, Monday, November 7th. Pursuant to Chapter 20 of the Acts of 2021, this meeting will be conducted via remote means. Members of the public who wish to access the meeting may do so via Zoom or by telephone. No in-person attendance of members of the public will be permitted, but every effort will be made to ensure the public can adequately access the proceedings in real time via technological means. And I'm going to go ahead and do a sound check. I believe that both Hala and Yvonne will not be able to join us today. Alexis, I'm very happy to see you. I wanted to speak with you about dates because I know you said Mondays are starting to be tough, so we'll do that too. So let's start with you, Ms. Bridges.
I'm right here.
Okay, we can hear you. Dr. Rhodes? Oh,
here, and I can hear. I can hear, and I assume I can be seen.
Very well seen, Dr. Rhodes. You are seen. Pamela?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay, excellent. And Alexis?
Good to be here. Thank you.
Great. And Dr. Shabazz?
Presente.
All right. And Jennifer, I think just let's, you're good.
You
okay.
Can hear me? I can hear you.
Yeah. And Hala, I didn't read your text in full, so I just told the group I didn't know if you were joining us. I'm so happy you're here. Yes. A little bit choppy, but I did hear your voice come through. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Great. All right. So welcome, everyone. Before we move into our agenda items, I wanted I wanted to take just a couple minutes for those of us who were able to join the Mojuba event yesterday that was co-hosted by the Black Assembly of Amherst, Massachusetts and Bridge for Unity. I first want to just really give a very deep and heartfelt thank you to the folks who sponsored and organized that event. It was extraordinarily powerful and very, very meaningful. So would love to hear from Dr. Shabazz and Hala and Dr. Rhodes about that just a little bit. I see before we do that, that Ms. Bridges' hands is up.
Yes. I was a little disturbed of something, so it disturbed my heart so much that I had to write it down. And I just wanted to read something, and I have to leave because I have a very important eye appointment. But yeah. Just let me get this out. I might stumble, but it's something that I need to say. As you know, my purpose of joining this committee was to add a descendant voice to the history of my ancestors that have been left out of the committee's initial reports. But we deserve, I feel, to have a voice in how our stories are told and shared, and I wanted to make sure future generations know about the everyday Blacks at the roots of Amherst history, where, you know, I wholeheartedly support events that share the Black history of Amherst. I was disheartened to read that the event yesterday that was promoted and supported by this committee claimed that it was, I quote, likely the first public event in Amherst to incorporate an honoring of Black ancestors. This is not only not the truth, but it's offensive, and it spreads information that to the community. I feel it causes harm to those who have done so before yesterday, who experienced the harm we are charged to repair, including myself. They date back decades, and recently as June 2021, the Juneteenth Heritage Walk in June 2022 in the Ancestral Bridges exhibit that closed this past Saturday, all included direct descendants honoring their Black ancestors in their burial ground of West Cemetery. Statements that moved the discovery of such, it just acknowledges to yesterday, erase those that came before. And I'm just very disturbed at it. And I just wanted you to know, sorry I have to leave the meeting, but please take what I said as coming from my heart. Because to read that, it was very disturbing. But I wish you all a good day. I got to go, and I'll see you at the next meeting.
Thank you, Ms. Bridges. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sharing that from your heart. We really appreciate it. My dog is deciding that he wants to bark something outside. So if we could just take a minute to pause here, I'm going to let my dog go outside, and we'll be right back in just a second. All right. So let's just check in here as a committee. I really want to honor Ms. Bridges' statement and voice. And I don't feel personally comfortable pursuing any conversation about Ms. Bridges' statement while she is not in the room. So what I would like to ask is that we hold that close to our heart, and that if Ms. Bridges would like to talk further about it in our next meeting, we allow there to be space for that to happen next meeting. In the meantime, if there's anything that any individual member feels like they would like to pursue individually with Ms. Bridges, with respect to her statement, I would encourage that. So I do want to just come back to the, so I started off by seeing if there was anybody who would like to speak in particular about the event that occurred yesterday. It does feel a little bit unsettling to talk about it again without Ms. Bridges here, given the context of her statement. However, if anybody would like to speak to the event, this would be the time to do that now. And we'll leave just a minute to do that. All right. Yeah. Yes, Alexis.
I'll just say I regret not being able to be there in person, but I want to thank Dr. Shabazz for live streaming because that allowed me to join in. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
All right. And I think I saw Dr. Shabazz, but before we go to you, Dr. Shabazz, I see Pamela's hand is raised.
I just wanted to ask a clarifying question. Was the event co-sponsored by this group or sponsored by another group and we just lend it support? I'm just trying to, I think you're, it's appropriate not to talk about it, but I would just like a little bit of information.
Sure. No, the event was in no way sponsored by the AHRA.
Okay.
Certain members of us sat on the panel and had a dialogue with Dr. Shabazz during the event, but the event was, Dr. Shabazz, why don't you jump in and say who the sponsors of the event were?
Absolutely. So the genesis of the event is with an intergroup dialogue organization called Bridge for Unity that has existed here for a number of years and attempts to try to promote intercultural and interracial understanding through intergroup dialogue as well as small as well as cultural exchanges. And the idea was presented of a celebration, an honoring of the ancestors, African ancestors here in Amherst, that would be conducted in a traditional West African, particularly Yoruba, ceremony. And folks who are two of our Bridge for Unity members who are long practitioners, initiated in this particular West African cosmology, spiritual system, offered to create the ceremonial part of the event. And that is what they did. And I think the kind of unfortunate thing in the press release and that I think was published in the Indy and perhaps in other places, and in fact, the language of it was attributed to a statement from me, but not in quote marks, but that but attributed to me, was saying that it was the first event of this kind to honor Black ancestors. But it should have read, or it should have been more clear, within this West African cultural framework. It was by no means This is the first time that Ancestors of Amherst, I was on the walk sponsored by Ancestral Bridges this past Juneteenth. I've been in terms of other activities here, whether in West Cemetery or elsewhere in town, honoring ancestors, African-American ancestors. So by no means would I wish to make a statement or would make a statement that it's the first time African ancestors, when I've attended and been a part of events that have done so, multiple events that have done so. So I do very much apologize and feel that was an unfortunate way that the language in which that came out. I think the sense of it was more, and we didn't even have to reference that as like a first, but I think the sense of what was conveyed, meant to be conveyed in the press release and in what was reported was in the within this West African spiritual tradition. It was one of the first times. But again, even that, we didn't necessarily have to say that or emphasize it, but certainly not to say the first that anybody has bothered to end to honor the ancestors. That would not, again, I'm a living witness that knows that that's not the first time anything has been done of that sort. So very much apologize for the wording that came out in the from the press release on that matter. But overall, I am was very excited. I'm very
Dr.
excited.
Buzz, could I just ask you one moment to pause? I'm going to come back to you. Just seeing that Ms. Bridges rejoined, I just wanted to let Ms. Bridges know if she can hear us. I think she's traveling. I don't see that her audio is connecting, but I'm just going to say this in the case that Ms. Bridges can hear us, that we agreed, Ms. Bridges, that I did not feel comfortable pursuing a conversation about this without you here, and everybody was in agreement about that, and that if there were individual conversations that could happen or if we could continue the conversation when you were back with us next meeting, that's what we would pursue. Pamela asked just a very direct question for the notes, I think, to ask whether this committee sponsored the event or who it was sponsored by. And the answer to that question is that the AHRA didn't sponsor the event. Members of the AHRA sat on the panel of the event, but it was co-sponsored by Bridge for Unity and the Black Assembly of Amherst, Massachusetts. And I think you came in, Ms. Bridges, when Dr. Shabazz was talking about the genesis of the event, how it came to be, who it was meant to recognize, and in which cultural framework. So if you have any questions, or of course the video will be available, you could hear through that as well. So I just wanted to make that. And did that clarify the question for you, Pamela? Okay, great. All right, so back to you, Dr. Shabazz. And Ms. Bridges, please, if you can speak and would like to speak, just go ahead and raise your hand. But right now it looks like your audio is having trouble connecting. Okay, Dr. Shabazz, back to you.
So just as far as that goes, I was very appreciative of the efforts of Rose Milligan Sackey and Dr. Trevor Baptiste for the energy and the brilliance and the very, very deep, careful, explanatory way for folks not very familiar with West African religious traditions, spiritual traditions, very explanatory about every aspect of it, the libation to the ancestors, the cleansing with the water, the Egun stick, and the ways in which that and in the Yoruba language, the words to recall and to remember all our ancestors, all our from the Middle Passage, who died on the Middle Passage to the Americas, who were brought here to Massachusetts in chains, enslaved in the years of the practice of slavery in Massachusetts, in Amherst in particular, that were very explanatory with everything. I appreciate both of them. They're both wonderful educators and wonderfully educational, spiritual folks. So very much appreciated that. That was one part of it. The event was three parts. One part was that part. The second part was the opportunity for members of the AHRA that could attend to update about where our process is. And then the third part consisted of breaking out into small breakout groups to discuss ideas feelings about the reparative justice process in Amherst, and then to report that back into the big group, and followed finally by some delicious food courtesy of the Black Sheep, the Blue Heron Restaurant, and Hazel's. So that was the whole enchilada for those who attended all of it, and seems to have been well received.
Thanks, Dr. Shabazz. It really was quite a moving and beautiful event. And I will say that the choir, was just, Hala, I just want to say, when you were singing with your hand in the air and your fist like up, it was so incredibly moving and touching, and I just thank you for what you brought to that and what the whole choir brought. So that was a piece that really moved me, so thank you for that. Dr. Shabazz, do you see an opportunity to offer in our next meeting a reporting of some of the feedback that was received when it came back from the smaller groups? Okay, great. That would be really good, I think, for us, if you think it's appropriate feedback for this body to have in terms of our work. That would be great. All right. Anything else on that? All right. So I'm going to give a quick update on two things, and then I'm going to pass, hopefully everyone received the email I sent today with Dr. Shabazz's position paper. He will be presenting that to us today. Dr. Rhodes and I have a hard stop today at 3:00 because we have a meeting set with the Donahue Institute. So this is update number one. We are going to meet with the Donahue Institute to further the discussion that we've been having around a survey and developing a survey that the AHRA can use to reach members of the community. I have asked our council president to join us in that conversation, because it's possible that the survey that we will conduct will include surveying around public health as well as community safety. And so we're going to have a discussion with the Donahue Institute today at 3:00, and we will report back to you at our next meeting on that. The second update that I wanted to offer is I do have it. okay, yes. I wanted to offer an update on the July 5th incident. So a couple weeks ago, I had updated the committee to say that I had made a motion that would evoke this committee or members of this committee to participate in another committee for a reconciliation process. And my vote did not pass through the council. It was a very close vote. It lost by one vote. And I recommend that everybody, if they haven't already, take a look at the video and the discussion, because it was a very rich and thoughtful and I think challenging discussion that the council had around that. So there isn't anything in terms of that that we need to be doing right now as a committee. However, I do want to leave some space perhaps for this committee to think about if there's anything that it would like to process around that. It won't be today, but we could certainly, if I hear from committee members that processing that in any way would be helpful, or if any action that this committee would like to take, for example, a letter to the council sponsored by the committee itself or something of that nature, we could think about that. So are there any questions about either of those updates, the survey or the July 5th? Yes, Alexa.
Are you looking for the questions just specifically about those updates or like discussion about those updates?
Anything. I wanted to at least give Dr. Shabazz a full, so if we have about 5 or 6 minutes so we can keep discussion going right now.
Okay, so I guess I just wanted to ask, in the event that the second motion doesn't pass, and I'm confused about all these rules, I'm going to be honest with you. So are you able to bring forward the same motion again, or like what happens if motion 2 doesn't pass?
That's a great question. So right now what's happening is there is a motion on the floor, which is known as motion 6. Lynn brought that motion, and that motion got tabled to tonight's meeting. In the meantime, Lynn asked that counselors provide any amendments or new motions. There were amendments that were provided. I provided a new motion. All of those can be found in the packet for tonight's town council meeting. However, I am aware that Lynn will be making a motion, which I believe will pass, to postpone the discussion in its entirety to next Monday, so that it has a designated time for it. Tonight is the town manager evaluation, as well as a tax classification hearing and financial indicators. So it's probably going to be an after midnight meeting as it is. And I think that's a good call. I really struggle to see it keep getting postponed, but it is good to have its own designated time. So if you'd like to see the amendments to the current motion, the new motion that I'm proposing that motion in addition to whatever else, because my motion is specific to the incident itself. It calls for an apology. It calls for a record of events. And it calls for research, legal research into compensatory repair models, options. So you could take a look at that and feel free to reach out with any questions to me individually and be happy to answer them. Dr. Shabazz?
Yeah, I'll keep it very short just to say that, you know, the original idea of formulating a working group that would include a representative from this body, from AHRA, along with representatives from the Human Rights Commission, as well as representatives from the Community's Safety and Social Justice Committee, along with counselors, I thought was a reasonable way to proceed. I supported it, and I was especially supportive because I was hearing in discussion, and I heard at that last meeting, Counselor Greismer bring up this notion of, you know, based upon discussion and our process within AHRA, that nothing could be done relative to compensation based upon, you know, the findings of KP Law and what's been generated in our process. And I was a little, you know, thought that that's where we could perhaps shed clarity in that, you know, our process is one thing. It's very different from this specific event. The two should not be confused, and that, yes, as this process is one that before any kind of direct payments or anything of that sort as part of the reparative justice plan we will submit, it will have to, you know, we understand it's going to go through this state legislative process. It would need to go through this, at least is what the attorneys had recommended, and that will take some time. But I feel AHRA, as we get into some of the specifics of items that could come under the reparative justice plan, to keep in mind the justice gap, to keep in mind the harm area of crime and punishment, the criminal justice system, and that we are hearing the need for that perhaps funds could go as one priority area to be able to compensate in situations where the criminal justice system or some aspect of it has operated in a racially unfair manner or discriminatory manner. But I think we're going to need to discuss that one a whole lot more, because first of all, I don't think the Reparative Justice Fund would be appropriate in instances that actually are, you know, dealing with immediate contemporary events that might need to be mediated or dealt with in some other way, and that we should not be used to say that, you know, you can't mediate or address those. Hopefully, outside of a lawsuit framework, the town can't address those unless it's in the AHRA process. So I don't want to get too deep into the woods on it, but just to say that I did support the idea, and I think it is something we ought to, I have heard brought up before, of whether the Reparative Justice Fund, one of the areas we might recommend, is how it could deal with instances like this. And that's going to be something we might want to spend some time talking about down the road.
Thank you for that, Dr. Shabazz. And Alexis, I realize I didn't answer your question as directly as I'd like to. So let me just say this one more piece. Yes, I could certainly bring back that motion. I chose not to because one, it didn't get the support the first time around that it needed to pass. And two, because the new motion that I've put forward hopes to deal directly with what the committee would have dealt with, so the apology, so a record keeping of what occurred, the compensatory pieces. And so while I really wanted the committee to be put in place to do that work, given that it didn't get the support that it needed, I chose a different strategy for this time. Thanks for asking that. Are there any other questions or comments about this? Dr. Shabazz, your hand is still up. Okay. Anything else? Dr. Rhodes, Hala, Pamela, Jennifer, Alexis. All right. Okay, so I'm going to pause before we turn things over to Dr. Shabazz to talk about his position paper and his framework that he'll be presenting to us today, and do a public comment period. So I am calling public comment now, and if you'd like to make a comment, please go ahead and raise your hand. I will call on you and ask that you state your name and your address, and you'll have up to 3 minutes. We normally do not respond, but we will be listening closely and sometimes can respond if there's a direct question. So if you'd like to make a public comment, please go ahead and raise your hand and we will bring you into the room. All right. Yes, Jennifer would like to make a public comment.
No, but can you guys approve the minute so I can get those posted and then give you guys another set of minutes to approve?
Yeah, absolutely. Does everyone feel that they are prepared to approve the 6:15, 7:06, and 7:25 meeting minutes? All right, great. So I will move to approve the 6:15, 7:06, and 7:25 2022 meeting minutes. Is there a second? Okay. I think it was Alexis and then Dr. Rhodes. So let's start with you, Hala. Okay, we'll come back. Alexis?
Yes.
Dr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Dr. Shabazz?
Yes.
I am also a yes. So for now, I think can we just put Hala as absent from the vote, or how would you like to record that, Jennifer?
Abstain. I'm just, yeah.
Okay. I think they pass.
I did say aye.
Oh, perfect. I'm sorry.
Didn't hear you.
Didn't hear you. Awesome. That's great. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So just to give some context, Dr. Shabazz, do you plan to share screen? Okay. So for folks who are listening, I just will briefly say that Dr. Shabazz has been working on a framework for us to consider as we move into eligibility criteria and use of funds and all of that stuff that we'll be discussing. And so he is going to present that to us now, and that will give us an opportunity then to begin that discussion. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Dr. Shabazz.
Dr. Shabazz, are you able to share screen?
I won't need to. I thought about trying to do a PowerPoint, but you've had the paper presented to you ahead of time, and I'm just going to highlight a few things very quickly, recognizing there is a hard stop for many of us. So with that, let me say that there's great interest, and it is very important for AHRA to grapple with the question of who is owed and who should receive reparations in Amherst. And the model that I am recommending to us for approval is what I think of as an inclusionary model, one that is not based upon restrictiveness, but is one that also recognizes certain critical priorities and targets for who is owed. There are three elements for us as a locally based reparative justice planning group. And then the three criterion areas are residency, lineage, and identity. So on the residential standard, the inclusionary model recognizes that the in terms of who should receive reparations or the benefits of a reparative justice plan should first and foremost prioritize those who live in Amherst. And so residency in Amherst is thus a critical priority area, but I don't but when I speak of an inclusionary model, I like for us to recognize that those not living in Amherst may have a stake as well as what happens here. So, for example, a 19-year-old who is away at college or in the military or in some other form of service that requires them to be outside of Amherst most of the year or at a point where temporarily their residency is no longer here in Amherst. They're not voting here. They're not paying taxes here. They are living elsewhere, but that this is not necessarily a permanent position or a permanent residency for them, and they do look to come back. In my view, then, they should not be excluded from the conversation. They should not be excluded from in regards to our residential standard, but that for in terms of our planning and in terms of who we're listening to, but that, again, we do recognize as a priority area those in relation to the residential standard, those who are living in Amherst now. Secondly, the lineage standard. The lineage standard has particularly come up almost from as this conversation has really begun to take off. And what this references is the debate over that when we talk about Black people, people of African descent, people of African heritage and whatnot, that we have to delineate or distinguish amongst those Black people, though amongst the Black population in the United States, those who have a lineage that goes back in time to over generations, multiple generations, and in fact goes back in time to having at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. This would effectively exclude people who have just arrived here in the United States. They could be African, they could be Black, and they could even have achieved citizenship. And they could even be a taxpayer over decades here in Amherst, but the fact that they were they don't have a presence in the United States that extends over multiple generations back to an ancestor enslaved in the United States by some models or definitions of the lineage standard, they would therefore be excluded from who is owed, who should receive benefits, and who should even be considered as part of the planning purposes of a reparative justice process. I disagree with that. I think instead what we need to assert is that those who meet that lineage criterion, that standard, in terms of having an ancestor who was enslaved in the United States, should be a priority area within our reparative justice planning, should be prioritized in certain respects of benefits that might be extended through our reparative justice plan if acted upon by the town council, but that should not mean that those who do not meet that criterion should be completely excluded. So, for example, someone whose family might have come here from the Caribbean in the late 1800s or come here in the early 1900s and have been here over multiple generations in Amherst, but simply for the fact that they don't have an ancestor that was enslaved in the United States, we would say in this inclusionary model, you are embraced. There may be benefits that could be extended through our reparative justice plan that could encompass those who don't have an ancestor that was enslaved in the United States. But again, this model would recognize that group with that multi-generational experience in the United States, with an ancestor enslaved in the United States, is a priority area and is one that our planning process should recognize, particularly in that part of our rationale is that we are attempting to pave the way for federal reparations, in which the lineage standard may well be the framework of federal reparations. Finally, there is the identity standard. And the identity standard is whether one defines themselves, identifies as Black, as of African heritage, as an African American. And again, by some advocates for reparations, especially in making the case for reparations at the federal level, They have insisted that that there be an identity standard. And one model goes that from the announcement of a reparative justice program. So, for example, we submit our report in June of 2023. It's read, it's digested. Let's say in the July or in the August council meeting, aspects of that plan or that plan is approved and adopted, and a reparative justice program begins to be implemented. The view of one model is that persons who would apply for or who might receive benefits must prove that they had identified as Black for at least 12 years before the start of the reparative justice program. So if we said August of 2023, we announce a program, then they would have to prove going back to at least, let us say 2010, that they have some type of documented proof of having identified as Black or been identified as Black. It could be the census return from 2010. It could be a driver's license from somewhere. It could be some form of official government a document that identifies them as Black or that African American, and that they were so identified and they professed that as their identity. What this really answers is a question one counselor raised some time back. What about mixed race people? Would mixed race people be eligible? And the answer then is resoundingly yes, as long as that mixed race person, in addition to identifying as mixed race, also identified as Black. And that doesn't go without saying. There could be some who have simply listed themselves and simply identify themselves as mixed race. And that doesn't tell you if they identify as Black. So one would have to have documentation within this identity standard that you may have identified as another race. You may have identified as mixed race, but that you have also documentation of identifying as Black, as of African descent. So for us in this inclusionary model, we recognize that identity standard. We acknowledge it as one that may be appropriate at the federal level and one that we should bear in mind in relation to our planning, but that we are not strictly, but that we can also embrace folks that may not have a proof prior, 12 years prior. But at least in my view, if they identify at the point of the reparations program, they still may be considered as eligible. But so that is in sum the discussion that I raise on the three identity standards. And this inclusionary model is one that acknowledges some of the frameworks that are being discussed that have been put forward at the federal level, but acknowledges them as simply areas that we could recognize and build some of our planning around, but that not necessarily relying completely on that for restrictive purposes, at least in our planning area. So it gives widest latitude for encompassing people as we move into defining benefits and defining different ways in which the funds and the programs that we ultimately endorse and put within our plan. It gives widest latitude for projects, ideas, proposals to be incorporated for people, both in those priority areas as well as maybe not within those priority areas. I open for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Shabazz. I saw Alexis's hand and then Dr. Rhodes.
Yeah, Dr. Rhodes can go first.
So this came in today, at least I saw it today. There's a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot of thought that needs to go into it to make it worthy of being able to respond to it, given your efforts, Dr. Shabazz. So I'm definitely not ready to talk about it because I'm really still unpacking it. And I printed it out and I started marking through it. And so, in order for me to offer any kind of meaningful feedback, I would have to have a little bit more time.
I think that's a really fair point for everybody. I appreciate Dr. Shabazz having gotten it to me, and I only got it to you all today. And so was hoping Dr. Shabazz would present it to us. It would go into the packet, and then we'll have a week to digest it, formulate questions, and be able to have a really meaningful discussion about it next week. Alexis.
Thank you. Thank you for this work, by the way, Dr. Shabazz. I appreciate you putting all of that together. So I have a complicated thing to throw in here because my life is complicated, and so why not speak from my experience, right? So being that I have, and I guess I'm wondering, if A and B aren't necessarily verifiable, and I know that puts, throws a wrench in it because the genealogy aspect, you could be, and I guess I'm wondering, and I know that like quantifying things have been extremely problematic in the past. I'm wondering, I guess, if that applies to anything, because, and here's my thing, right? So I wasn't allowed, at least on my birth certificate, to say that I wasn't white because my grandma and my mom decided that that was a politically smart idea. Not that I wasn't born out of a black woman, right? But like politically speaking, that was a decision made outside of me. And that's not to say that in census reports and stuff like that, and like, in the SATs and the MCAS and whatever else that we had to say where we had to check the boxes about what we were, it was always African-American and white. But I guess like for me, that data is very, sometimes it's this, sometimes it's this. And it was based off of the information that I was receiving from my black family members. That's the one piece, right? The second piece is that, and that was for very particular reasons, and I'm gonna be fast about this. But the second piece is that I was able to trace back my genealogy only so far, because of course, right, being when you have enslaved ancestry, not everything gets recorded and not everything lasts. So I was able to trace back my ancestry to Robert E. Lee on my black side. And his son was Peter Lee, who was labeled, in the records as being a mulatto. And from there, they married black until my mom messed it up. I'm just joking. But, it was basically like that, right? And so that's reaching back to like 18-something. I know Robert E. Lee was born in like 1805. And so I know for a fact that Peter Lee was not enslaved. But his mother there's absolutely no records at all to be able to find his mother. And I highly doubt that this person consensually had a baby with Robert E. Lee, right? Who is obviously not white. So I guess I'm wondering, in the event that you don't have lineage proof through paperwork, and being that I have literally a black mother, I guess I'm wondering, like, how do you prove that, especially when my data is all jumbled up, right?
May I make a quick response, Chair, folks?
Yes, indeed.
I just want, first of all, express appreciation for your sharing, for your honesty in respect of this, and to say this is exactly the complexity that I am wrestling with and I'm trying to contend with in this position paper, that in many of the frameworks that have been written about and been pushed at the federal level. And most notably, in my reparations seminar, we have been diving into Darity and Mullen's book, From Here to Equality. And we've been tearing it up that there are so many holes. There's so many areas that this blanket kind of approach that they take don't anticipate. And so I want to highlight, first of all, with respect to the lineage complexity. This is where I believe in our final plan, we ought to consider endorsing a motion to state government and federal government to, as one step of reparations, to fund the availability of DNA and genealogical research for people of African descent to avail themselves of who want to. Because to try and have to do this on your own, and then consider this, we talk about the wealth gap. If you're poor, where are you going to get the resources to hire a genealogist or to hire, to pay these $200, $300, whatever dollar kits, DNA kits, and then get the interpretation from it to then be able to go and prove you deserve reparations? Who's got those thousands of dollars available? Because let me tell you, professional genealogists are not cheap. Okay? So who's able to do that? All right? So that is a question I don't see in From Here to Equality. I don't see from advocates that push this lineage standard as like, you know, fixed. You know, and we've even gotten letters to our assembly, you know, saying we're treasonous because we don't hold to a strict lineage standard. Well, how are we supposed to prove this? You're just going to show up there for you expect the federal government to go do all of that? That's not how benefits work. The benefits work from the federal, in the case of the Japanese, you had to show, you had to come and present the evidence that you had, that you were interned or that you had a parent or grandparent who was interned to get your $20,000. Now, what the support group, the advocacy group for Japanese reparations did is they, you know, got support together to go and do a lot of that documentation and to get from the government, because the government kept records on all the people they locked up in the internment camps. So they did a lot of that legwork to get the evidence to create the role of who got the $20,000 checks. Okay, but how do you do this for potentially 36 million African Americans or more, actually more, that could be eligible under the federal plan? So somebody's got to take responsibility I think the federal government ought to take responsibility to help provide the genealogical research and the DNA research, the finding your roots, if you will, for African Americans, of which this is one of the direct harms that broke us from having any kind of ability to trace our lineage like that. So that's one area with respect to the lineage. On the identity one, this is another important complexity that, again, by my recognizing the issue of that some have raised of the need to show documentation at more than a decade before the start of the reparations program, that just saying that can be easy for the policymaker or for the, you know, the economist to come up with that, but the implications on the ground for masses of people can also be challenging in ways you have to really think about. You know, faced with a white supremacist, structurally racist system, a white parent and a black parent, it is, in my mind, completely reasonable that they might opt to say, in a choice of what bubble to fill out, they might say W and not say black and not, or not say other or not say multiple. Okay, and it is their choice to do so. But then what does that mean down the line with respect to a reparative justice process in which that infant had no choice at the point that those boxes were, that W box was checked? What does that say for them? Are they thus, you know, their entitlement to what is owed negated because of the decisions being made between one or both parents to mark the W box? Even when they could perhaps prove the lineage standard, you know, and show that they had an ancestor who was enslaved through their black side, they could still then be disqualified on the basis of the identity standard. So I think, again, what you've just presented highlights some of the complexities that I think as we grapple with this on the local level, my recommendation is to have this inclusionary model that acknowledges the priority areas or the targets or the standards that have been raised for the federal reparative justice process, but doesn't limit our attention strictly to those more restrictive standards that have been advocated.
Thank you, Dr. Shabazz. And we will certainly have much more conversation around this. That was really rich and very appreciative to you, Alexis, for sharing that personal piece to give us this ability to discuss these nuances and the complexities. Dr. Rhodes, if you want to jump off while I call one more public comment to get on with Kerry, feel free to do that. That didn't take long. I'm just going to call one more public comment to see if there is anybody in the audience who would like to make a public comment. You are able to just go ahead and raise your hand, please, and we will bring you into the room. You have up to 3 minutes to make a public comment, and we will be listening very carefully to you. Okay, not seeing any, just want to thank the attendees who joined us today. Really, really appreciate you being here, and please continue to join us. I can't really see what you're showing, but okay, so are there any other comments or questions by counselors or Pamela and Jennifer? All right. And Alexis, I'll touch base with you about scheduling, and may everyone have a beautiful week, and we'll see each other next week again, and I'm going to adjourn at 3:02 p.m. Thank you. I love that. Bye.
Jennifer, if you could keep it open for a second just for me to reach out to Pamela. And Michelle, you can go. This is... Okay. I just been wanting to say to you, Pamela, been very interested in...
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Represent NYC on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. I'm Julie Walker. Today we will be talking about financial reparations for slavery. How do we as a country, a state, or even a city make amends for the enslavement of the approximately 4 million Africans and their descendants, men and women who were enslaved in the United States and the colonies that became the United States? The first question we have to ask is, can the legacy of slavery be untangled from its economic impact on America? The fact is, African slaves unwillingly played a major role in building the infrastructures of the United States. Slaves were a free labor force that was the cornerstone of a flourishing economy. A free labor force that here in New York literally built Wall Street and expanded Lower Manhattan. Can our nation or our city make amends for the exploitation or the lynching? Can it undo the cumulative effects of the Jim Crow laws, redlining, and injustices experienced by African Americans during slavery and after it officially ended? If the United States owes a financial debt to the modern-day descendants of slaves, then the solution, some say, is reparations. And other northern cities accrued vast wealth from slave labor and profited for centuries from dealing in the slave trade. According to historians, the first 11 enslaved people were owned by the Dutch West Indian Company for the purpose of building up New Amsterdam, or as we call it now, New York City. New York City was a major hub of the African slave trade. The first slave auction was held in Lower Manhattan in 1655, and an official slave market opened in 1711 by the East River on Wall Street between Pearl and Water Streets. Africans who passed through the Wall Street slave market contributed to the prosperity of some very famous companies that are still around today. Between 1732 and 1754, black slaves accounted for more than 35% of the total immigration through the port of New York. Slaves made up about 25% of the population. Earlier this month, I spoke to Dr. Ron Daniels with the National African American Reparations Commission and Linda Day, professor of Africana Studies at Brooklyn College, about the fight for reparations in New York. Professor Day, can you please provide us with a brief history of slavery in New York for those who may not know?
So the enslaved population really grew after 1626 when the colonists, the New Amsterdam, Dutch West India Company, decided that they needed to bring Africans into New York, what became New York, for the purposes of labor and doing some of the heavy work of building the colony. So the New York City slave market really grew after the British took over in the 1700s. And the population of enslaved people in New York was 20% or more at various times. And indeed, it exceeded the number of enslaved persons in other colonies in the 13 colonies other than Virginia for the longest time, up until the federal period. So it wasn't until 1827 that technically slavery in New York, or people to be enslaved born in New York, became illegal. But to have a person that was enslaved in New York was not illegal until the 1840s.
So what are some of the ways that New York benefited from the slave trade even after it was abolished? And how did this impact generational wealth?
Well, certainly there were people in New York, many of the wealthy bankers, industrialists, factory owners, shipbuilders, shipmakers were involved in the products of enslavement after slavery, because the northern industrialists were working to refine the sugar that was made in the South, to refine the cotton that was grown by enslaved persons in the South. So Brooklyn, New York, people like the Livingstons were wealthy because of their work and the slave trade and because of their shipbuilding operations. So there was a lot of wealth that was created in New York on the backs of enslaved people from the South. And at the same time, the people that were in the enslaved population were losing every generation. There was no way for them to accumulate property while they were enslaved, and it was even difficult to maintain family ties when children were being sold away from their parents, wives were sold away from their husbands. It was difficult to even maintain familial ties in those days.
So turning now to Dr. Daniels, you are the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. Can you briefly tell us the mission of your organization and how it was founded?
Well, the mission of the National African American Reparations Commission is to, first and foremost, to create a 10-point reparations program, which we have. And that 10-point reparations program is designed to be a frame of reference for reparations initiatives around the country. In addition to that, we're supporting H.R. 40, which is the bill first introduced by Congressman John Conyers in 1989, which was initially a bill to study whether or not enslavement warranted reparations. Because of the involvement of the folks who are part of the commission, including the organization in COBRA, We've changed that bill now to a study, a remedy bill. So it's no longer the bill, which is now before Congress, which is being sponsored by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, is a bill to study reparations proposals for African Americans, which means that we're now in the remedy phase. So in broad terms, we have a number of outstanding commissioners. We work very closely with the CARICOM Reparations Commission. There are a lot of people who are not aware that in the Caribbean there is a CARICOM Reparations Commission. It has a 10-point program. We work very closely with them. But we also do work in communities. So the work that we've done at the national level has helped to be synergistically related to some of the work that's being done here in New York, particularly in terms of the introduction of the bill in both the House and the lower chamber and the upper chamber to talk about an H.R. 40 type bill. And we've just come out of Evanston, Illinois, where in the city of Evanston, Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons has introduced a bill that was passed where there will be $10 million over the next 10 years to deal with reparations in the city of Evanston. The reason why that's important is as commissions like the ones that are being set up in New York and the kind of research that the professor is doing, it means that we're going to begin to talk about how reparations should actually be paid at the local level in addition to the national level.
So, Professor, can you give our viewers an idea of the amount of money we're talking about when it comes to New York profiting from free labor and investing in products that relied on slave labor? Would it be in the thousands, in the millions, and how can examining this history shine a light on the amount of damage done?
Well, certainly, for example, something like Citibank. The people that founded Citibank were involved in the slave trade. So there's no, how can we even calculate the amount of wealth that Citibank controls? So that wealth over time, we're talking in the millions and millions of dollars if you do aggregate all of the wealth that was created through the slave trade, through the products of slave labor. It's in the millions for sure.
So Dr. Daniels, you talked about a 10-point plan that the National African American Reparations Commission rolled out. What are some of the highlights of that plan, and how did the organization come to those conclusions?
Well, if I could just also chime in a little bit on this topic, because I think it is not really understood the degree to which the wealth of this country is built on the backs of slave labor, both in terms of the acceleration principle, the multiplier effect, which means that because of this tremendous amount of wealth was generated and indeed was built. So I really appreciate what the professor has laid out in that regard. Well, in terms of looking at our 10-point program, we basically looked at what the CARICOM Commission had dealt with, and we modeled it in that way. And it's pretty basic. We're looking at issues like housing, economic development, health care, communications, the whole right of return of Africans to go back to Africa should they choose to do so, sacred sites. Probably here in the state of New York, there are sacred sites that need to be recovered. Certainly the African burial ground was an example of a sacred site that was there that the community had to fight to preserve. And this is a part of the wound that our people suffer. My church, St. Mark AME Church, there's a whole series on PBS about the Iron Coffin Lady, because we discovered that in this free community, actually, you had this kind of development. So we've made that contribution. And I think there's certain key areas that we should focus on. First of all, the whole notion that there should be apology, but there also has to be restitution. And in making that restitution, one of the critical questions we've addressed is whether there should be individual payments and how much and so forth. First of all, you could never pay enough in terms of the damages done to our people. But we also want to make a distinction between individual payments, or what we call direct benefits, which can be made if we can find those persons who were directly affected. But that's often where it gets hung up. Well, we don't know who they are and so forth. Well, we're saying that we know for sure that the black community was underdeveloped because of this. So no matter who is in the community now, we're looking at how do we collectively benefit that community. So we put forth something called a reparations finance authority. The concept of having a board, if you will, be created of people from all walks of life, including activists and organizers, who can contribute to making decisions about how reparations would be dispensed. For example, if, on public land, the United States has plenty of public land, if public land were made available, then we could create hospitals. We could create educational institutions. Well, that's not just for Ron Daniels or my family. That is for the totality of the black community to benefit from. So we're focusing very much on what we call community benefits that will accrue to all people of African descent who are in communities around the country.
So you mentioned initiatives in other communities. So how has the idea of reparations varied across the nation?
Well, I think it's just beginning to bubble up and percolate. And let me just say that in that regard, the Movement for Black Lives has made an extraordinary contribution to that conversation. Ta-Nehisi Coates with his discussion dealing with redlining. Because what people should also understand that we're talking about enslavement, but we're also talking about all of those discriminatory policies, racially exclusive policies that emanated post-emancipation, like the Homestead Act, like the FHA, like the GI Bill, and redlining. Almost in Evanston, Illinois, this was one of the great questions that people were being redlined out of their property. They were literally being moved from the lakefront into black communities, which meant wealth was reduced and whatnot. So what we're finding is around the country, people are just beginning to bubble up with this kind of assertion. And you're finding students on universities challenging, for example, the University of Chicago or Georgetown University, where it's been discovered that these institutions have benefited from enslavement. And the universities are sort of dragging their feet, but students are coming forth and saying, well, here's where we stand. We're willing to have a portion of our student benefits, our student revenue, go to help repair the damage. So there's a series of these things beginning to bubble up. Where the commission comes in is we are working to make sure that reparations is reparations. It's not just ordinary public policy. And what do we mean by that? First of all, the party that inflicts the harm cannot define the remedy, fundamental principle. Secondly, there must be remedies in which the people themselves are independently in control of the dispensation and allocation of those resources. So what we're doing is making sure that everything is not just called reparations. We want to make sure that reparations has a certain definition, a set of criteria, which are longstanding in terms of the history of the struggle for reparations and is codified by the guidance of international law.
Professor Day, what are some examples of institutional racism, like within housing, banking, and schooling, that occurred since slavery created disparities for African Americans?
Well, Brother Daniels mentioned redlining in Evanston. We had redlining right here in Brooklyn and all through New York and on Long Island. So redlining, housing covenants, for example, in Levittown, which had covenants which barred the sale of those properties to non-Caucasians, and that was in the 40s and the 50s and up until the 60s until various legislations made that kind of racial covenant illegal. So not to mention school segregation that came because of residential segregation, and there have been fights over that. Certainly Malvern on Long Island was the first in New York State to be under a mandate to desegregate their schools. And it caused a great deal of tension in the community. And indeed, the black school, which could potentially have been improved with more funding, was simply closed. And those black students, those children had to walk for miles to the newly integrated white elementary schools in the farthest reaches of their community. So there have been many examples of that kind of thing all through New York. The GI Bill, as Brother Daniels mentioned, was highly discriminatory against who would get loans and under what circumstances. So once people are already impoverished and don't have a lot of wealth, they are then also discriminated against in terms of their ability to accumulate or to borrow more wealth. So the wealth gap continues to grow, has continued to grow over the years, such that now the average white household wealth of $100, for that $100, and the average black household has $5.04. So the wealth disparity is great, longstanding, and continues.
So Dr. Daniels, why are reparations so important in this day and age?
Well, it's not just this day and age, it's long overdue in this day and age.
Justice.
And what we find, however, is important is the surging interest, the surging coming together of so many institutions. And so that damage has to be repaired. And I want to stress again something the professor talked about in that regard as well. It is understanding the intergenerational benefits and deficits. And it's really very necessary, particularly not only for African Americans, but for whites to understand this. Because very often whites say, I didn't have anything to do with it. We're not indicting you individually. It's just that there were opportunities opened up to you because of enslavement that African Americans were denied. So with the Industrial Revolution, for example, black people were held in the South as sharecroppers, agricultural laborers, and so forth. It was a new form of slavery. We could have been brought to the North, and even though that was difficult, because within the context of class, those who were in charge ruthlessly exploited white labor as well. But it was still better to be working in a factory, a foundry, or a plant, or a mine, than being locked into sharecropping. So the point is, and then what happened was, in the period right after the Civil War, this country brought out of Europe 13, 14 million European immigrants came. Now, they were able to come in and take advantage of factory jobs, with even though they were low wage, there was no wage in the South. So that wealth, that potential and opportunity could be passed on intergenerationally. But to African Americans, it was a deficit. So having that understanding, we have a sense that if, in fact, people knew better, they would do better. Now, I'm not optimistic that, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, particularly in the white community, will come to understand it, because there's something called white privilege as well. But there's a sufficient number of people who can join with what Martin Luther King would call this community of conscience and concern to move this forward. So, for example, the American Civil Liberties Union has recently joined the fray. They're supporting H.R. 40. We're working, the commission, NARC, with them to have hearings around the country and town hall meetings. Human Rights Watch is about to also do likewise. There are faith organizations that are involved. And we have institutions like Virginia Theological Seminary just come up and says, we're guilty. We want to figure out what we can do. So there is now a surging interest that we can ride in order to do what Langston Hughes said was never done. He said, America has never, ever been America to me. Well, there is the prospect somewhere down the line that there can be a new covenant where reparations really begins to heal, first and foremost, black communities, but in so doing, it will help heal this nation.
Why are reparations so important now? There's a lot of tension in this country now, and so much of it does come from people not understanding the real history of this country. There's so many blinders on all over this country, and if there's any way for America to in any way, shape, or form reach the potential that it has to come to grips with this slavery, this history. It has to come to grips with this disparity, this racial disparity that's been there, is still there, and will continue to kind of foment tensions unless it's addressed properly. And certainly this push and understanding of the need for reparations and then an implementation of plans to institute reparations for the real history of discrimination in this country, that's a way for the people in America to really begin to come to a better understanding of who we are, what we're about, and how we can go forward.
So just briefly, my last question to the two of you, and again, just briefly, why does the word reparations seem to scare so many people?
Well, I think when it comes to many in white America, they think that somehow this is a gift. I mean, why are we giving this away? Don't black people have mayors now and artists and entertainers and all this? I mean, so why should we do this? And it has nothing to do with me. So it really, in some ways, engenders antagonism. It's because it's not really understood, because real history is not taught in this country. And so when Professor Days talks about unpacking real history, this is a part of that process.
Professor Days? And yes, the reparations talks about repairing a disparity, repairing an injustice. But many people don't even know what that injustice is. They don't understand it. And yes, they think it's something that has nothing to do with them, when in fact the country is built on it. And 1619 was, as many people have now said, the beginning of the real history of this country. And most people don't have a clue about that real history.
Professor Linda Day, thank you very much. Dr. Ron Daniels, thank you as well.
It's wonderful being here.
Thank you for having us.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. Slavery in the U.S. officially ended in 1865, but the trauma of slavery didn't end with the end of the Civil War. After the war, selected slaves were promised reparations in the form of land and mules to farm. 40 acres and a mule. It was called Field Order No. 15, and it set aside confiscated Confederate land for freed slaves. After President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, the new president, Andrew Johnson, reversed this order, giving the land back to its former Confederate owners. We spoke with Professor Jessica Gordon-Nemhard about the long history and the cry for reparations.
My name is Jessica Gordon-Nemhard. I'm professor of community justice and social economic development at John Jay College. The request for reparations started back in the 1700s and 1800s, especially right after the Civil War, because at least after the Civil War, we had laws in the United States that said that slavery was outlawed. So as soon as we had laws that said that the country recognized that slavery was wrong, that the slave trade was wrong, we've had people petitioning. In the 1790s, there was an organization called the Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, started by a woman named Callie House. And that organization argued that because enslaved people were workers and hadn't been paid, we at least deserved pensions, if not back pay. Once enslavement was over, African Americans were left on their own and had no way often to make a living to support their family. So it's a long movement that's been responsive to all the different levels of enslavement and oppression and economic injustice that African Americans have suffered here on U.S. soil. New York State was a slave state and didn't abolish slavery until 1799. We have all the sins of being a slave state upon us. New York City has the Black Burial Ground Museum, and they actually list all the slave codes and the laws. Black people weren't allowed to be out after dark without a lantern. They couldn't own land. They couldn't testify in court. They couldn't congregate more than three people at a time, so they couldn't even go to a funeral. So New York State is complicit on the slavery side, even though we ended slavery earlier than the federal government did. We were actually the last northern state to end slavery. Any of us today who have inherited any kind of wealth, most of that wealth was on the backs of either enslavement, unpaid labor, or benefiting from the slave trade. Even today, because not just of the past, but the cumulative benefits to one group and the cumulative disadvantages to another group, something needs to happen, because what's happening right now is not making up for those. It's still allowing the people who started out with the benefits to benefit more and more, and still leaving other people behind.
Welcome back. Bill H.R. 40 calls for a commission to study and develop reparations for African Americans. This is part of a growing movement for a historical investigation into the long-term effects of slavery. Here in New York, Democratic leaders are looking to do the same thing. We spoke to Assembly members Inez Dickens and Charles Barron about their bill to form the New York State Community Commission on Reparations Remedies. Assemblymember Barron, you're the sponsor of a bill that establishes the New York State Community Commission on Reparation Remedies and makes an appropriation of $250,000. What motivated you to write this legislation?
First of all, let me say that we have to keep the reparations discussion in the context of a larger issue. There are a lot of singular issue organizing when you do police brutality, reparations. But if there's no radical systemic change of this racist, parasitic, capitalist system, then even if we get reparations, we'll just be getting reparations without liberation, and we'll be well-paid and well-fed and still on American plantation. So putting it in that context, I thought it would be important to go state by state. States should deliver the reparations, because trying to get a federal bill is going to be incredibly difficult. But if each state could look at the history in New York State, you want to find out the history of slavery in New York State, just look at the street signs. When we go up to Albany, we get off at Rensselaer and Albany. Rensselaer was a slaveholder. When I walk through my beloved community of East New York, Skank Avenue, slaveholder. Van Sicklin, Dutch, slaveholder. So when I read the history of New York City and found out that New York City was the largest slaveholding city in the country, second only to Charleston, South Carolina, I said, we need to do reparations on a state level. So the bill is focusing on a community commission, not a state commission. 14 members will be on that commission. 9 will come from the community, 5 from the state, the governor's office, 2 from the Senate, and 2 from the assembly. But it should be a community commission and not studying reparations, because we already know the fact that we were enslaved and it damaged us to this day. But what are the remedies? So the commission's mission is to, 1, how much should we get paid, and what form should it be in? And 2, who is eligible to receive it? You hear a lot of debates and arguments, should it go to an individual, should it go to the community? And let me just make one last point. We need to make, and this is a difficult challenge and distinction, between what we're supposed to be getting as taxpaying citizens, like education, housing, health care. That's not reparations. That's what we're supposed to get as taxpaying citizens. Reparations is a debt owed. Pay your debt. And when people say, well, how much do you owe us? If I say a billion, if I say a trillion, they say, ha, 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 we don't even have that in the budget. Well, you know what you could do? Just like we pay on the debt service in the state, you can pay a debt service to us, a billion each year, until you pay up whatever we calculate as the amount. So that's what reparations, it's a debt owed. It's not something that they should give taxpaying citizens for what they're supposed to get anyway.
And I just want to add to that, because Assembly Member Barron mentioned about New York State being a slaveholding state. Many people don't realize when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by the President, Abraham Lincoln, it was only supposedly to free the slaves in the states that had left the Union. In other words, states right. like New York that right. stayed in the Union, it did not
apply.
Relieve slavery at all in any of those
That's
states.
Correct.
So I just wanted to add that, because we don't know
Very
the
important.
History. We don't know this.
That's right.
And it did not stop slavery at all in New York or New Jersey or any other state that was stayed in the Union. It was only for those states as
point.
A punishment to
Very
those states
point.
Who left the Union.
That's right.
So, Assemblymember Dickens, you signed on as a co-sponsor
yes.
of this legislation. Other than what you just mentioned, what else motivated you to sign on?
Because I've always believed in reparations. I believe that we are owed a debt. The Irish felt they were owed a debt, and this is not to be racism. This is just talking about history for the potato famine. The Jewish community for what happened during World War II or prior to World War II in Germany. So I have, and I have no problems with any other nationality feeling that they are due reparations. Why should there be a problem when black people feel that reparations is due?
So Assemblymember Barron, what's the current state of this piece of legislation that you wrote?
Well, right now we have about 40 people signed on. For the second year in a row, it was voted out of the Government Operations Committee. At the time, the newly appointed majority leader, Crystal People Stokes, was the chair. So it was voted out of that committee. It is now sitting in the Powerful Ways and Means Committee. So the next stop, it gets to the floor. What we have to do now is double that 40 and get to 80, because it's 76 votes is what gets a bill to the floor in the state assembly. We're at 40 now, so this term, this session, we want to get to 80, get it to the floor, and then Senator Sanders, James Sanders, has the same as bill in the Senate. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no reason why we got a black head of the Senate, a black head of the Assembly, a so-called, emphasis on so-called, progressive governor. Why don't we have this reparations bill in New York City? And the bill is saying the commission will recommend the remedies to the state assembly. It still has to be approved by the state assembly. So there's no reason why this shouldn't pass. And I just might want to add, on the national level, it's very disingenuous for now the Democrats to be talking about reparations when they, in fact, had control of the Senate and the House and the president, a black president in 2008, and John Conyers, who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee where his bill was in, may he rest in peace, never got the light of day in 2008 when they could have passed it. Now we got a madman in the White House and we got a Republican Senate. Now you're talking about reparations? We're at the point in our state bill, it's in-house ways and means. I'm going to push it and get more sponsors this year and try to get it to the floor, even if we have to do a one-house bill in the Assembly until the Senate catches up. Do you know that we have a $177 billion state budget, a $92 to $93 billion city budget? How do you have a state with $260 billion have some fiscal problems? And then the Jewish community was able to get out of the city council money for Holocaust survivors, and New York State had nothing to do with the Holocaust, but they got money out of the city council and they get it every year. So don't talk to me about no fiscal problem. And even on the national level, you got $773 billion for the military, but you don't have, every time we want something, how you gonna pay for it? Do they ask you how they gonna pay for billion-dollar wars? And how did this nation get into a $20 trillion debt? And the city has a $50 billion debt, and the state has a $53 billion debt. They have money. It's about the will.
So, Assemblymember Barron, what would you say to someone who says, well, I'm not personally responsible for the atrocities committed against African Americans, and therefore I shouldn't pay reparations?
And I wasn't personally responsible for the atrocities committed against the Japanese. And in 1988, Ronald Reagan gave reparations to the Japanese for their internment in the 1940s. I'm not responsible for the Holocaust, but the city council is using my taxpaying dollars to pay Jewish people who were affected by the Holocaust. I don't care if you came here last night. The nation owes someone a debt. Once you become a citizen of that nation that owes someone a debt, then you are responsible for paying that debt to people who have been affected. They only run this stuff to us, not to other people.
And you know, I see you're ready to answer the same question.
We helped build this nation. I mean, it was built on our backs.
That's right.
It was our backs that it was built on. We were the ones that were beaten. We were the ones that were strung up and still are, by the way.
That's
nothing new.
That's right.
All you got to do is just look at the paper. And why shouldn't we? We helped. This is a nation we built. This is a state we helped build.
That's
this
right.
is not someone else. This is our. We had the input of blood, sweat
and
tears.
And if those people say they don't want to pay the debt because they had nothing to do with our enslavement, then don't reap the benefits, because you are milking the benefits for our labor. We cleared the roads, we built the homes, we built the bridges, we built their forts, and we were agriculturalists, Africans were. When they came to New York in 1627, remember the Dutch in New Amsterdam? They brought us here to clear the roads and teach them how to do agriculture, because the Dutch only knew how to do fur trading. We built the economy of this city, this state, and this country. So don't talk to us about why should you have to pay. Then don't accept the benefits for our blood, sweat, and tears if you don't want to pay the debt.
So I know we touched on this, and everything we said up till now basically leads to this question. Why is the case for reparations so important in this day and age?
Well, one, we have to tell the story. Our children need to know the truth about this nation. Lincoln didn't free any slaves. He was a racist who wanted to import us, send us back to Africa. Christopher Columbus did not discover America. Indigenous people were already here. So the story is very important to say that the indigenous people, they stole this land, and then they stole us from Africa to build the foundation of this racist capitalist system. Secondly, it's important now because our communities are in a crisis. We're in a dangerous crisis in every social indicator, and it's time for this wealthiest nation in the world, one of the wealthiest states in the world, the wealthiest city in the world, to take care of the 40% poverty in the South Bronx, 30 and 40% poverty in Harlem and in East New York, and our median income is low, homelessness. They need to take care of that. That's the crisis. We paid the price with our blood, pay the debt.
Reparations, if that was to be put in place, it would open the door for the truth to be told. In education, they've never really told the true story about slavery or about the history of the black man or woman, the black families in this country. I believe that the books could be rewritten and would be rewritten if that was done, if no more than the people were angry that you got reparations. You know, many of our own people, we go to school and we learn the wrong history. Right. We learn that what everybody else did, and we know nothing about our own people and what we did, how hard we worked, whether we're talking about Crispus Attucks, who took over a boat or ship in the harbor, whether we're talking about Jane Doe, who was beaten and worked in the fields. It would tell the true story, or the beginning, I should say, of the true story of the black family in this country.
Right.
So I think it's important to recognize the distinction between reparations and reparation remedies. And your bill specifically is asking for a commission on reparation remedies.
Right.
So what are the next steps if this legislation is written into law?
Well, if this is written into law, the commission will be set up. They'll get $250,000 to bring in professors on the economy and the impact on African people in New York City, to bring in all of the experts. And then after the experts are brought in, maybe for a year, and then make recommendations on remedies to the New York State Assembly. And those recommendations should be passed by the Assembly and the Senate, signed by the governor, and put into practice, put into institutions and agencies, so that we can then benefit for the work that our ancestors have done, the blood that was spilled. And I just want to let people know the African Holocaust is the worst Holocaust, along with the indigenous people, so-called Indians, known to humanity. We lost millions on the Middle Passage. We lost millions on the plantation experience, and we're losing millions now to police brutality, to poverty, to homelessness, to crime. So the greatest crime against humanity is to have us build this nation and then treat us less than animals, less than human beings should be treated. The 13th Amendment says slavery shall be abolished except as a punishment for crime, thus the prison industrial complex.
So Assemblymember Dickens, what is the biggest obstacle to this legislation that you are co-sponsoring?
Our own minds. That's the biggest obstacle. Our own thinking. And when I say our own thinking, I'm not talking about any color or creed of an assembly member or the public. I'm talking about all of us. Because some of us in our own communities see no need for a reparations remedy. And so it's our own thinking. In other communities, they're never going to be, and I'm going to bring something else into this. You know, maybe I shouldn't, but because this is going to be something that's going to open the door for another segment. But we're talking about cannabis and the legalization of it. And we're talking about money coming in. whether it's taxes, licenses, whatever, that would go into the communities that have been adversely affected. Well, obviously, that's the black and brown communities. And what's happening is now they're saying, well, why should it only go to those communities? You know, I mean, there's always been, and it's racism that says you can't have it. It's just, that's just the bottom. And, you know, you can be racist against your own.
And I think we're going to have to just leave it there. Thank you both very much, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's been more than 400 years since the first Africans were kidnapped and imported to this new world. Though it is impossible to give accurate figures, some historians have estimated that 6 to 7 million enslaved people were brought here during the 18th century alone. Many did not survive the passage. And by the end of the Civil War, some 3.4 million black people remained in bondage in spite of the Emancipation Proclamation. Today, there remains a large divide between Americans of different racial and ethnic backgrounds on the issue of reparations. A 2019 AP poll revealed that 74% of black Americans and 44% of Hispanics are in favor of reparations, compared with 15% of white Americans. We'll be right back, but first, let's hear what some of the 2020 Democratic candidates for president have said about reparations.
I believe we have to invest in those communities that have been so hurt by racism. It doesn't have to be a direct pay for each person, but what we can do is invest in those communities, acknowledge what's happened.
I would do my best to change the banking system to make sure that we end racism, that we pay attention to distressed communities, that people get the loans they need to make the investments they need.
What about free cash payouts?
No.
Remember, we're not talking about a gift to anybody. We're talking about mending what was broken. We're talking about the generational theft of the wealth of generations of African Americans. And just crossing out a racist policy and replacing it with a neutral one is not enough to deliver equality. Harms compound, just like a dollar saved in its value compounds over time. So does the value of a dollar stolen. And that is why the United States must act immediately with investments in minority-owned businesses, with investments in health equity, with investments in HBCUs, and on the longer term, look at reparations so that we can mend what has been done.
I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country. And that means I support the bill in the House to appoint a congressional panel of experts, of people who are studying this, who talk about different ways we may be able to do it, and to make a report back to Congress so that we can, as a nation, do what's right and begin to heal.
In the mid-1930s, to lift America out of the Great Depression, the New Deal created huge economic programs sponsored by the federal government. These are the policies that eventually built what we now know as the middle class. We spoke with Professor Alan Singer of Hofstra University about the economic imbalances and the resulting call for reparations.
The more I studied the history of the United States, the more I came to realize that slavery and racism are at the core of American history. Slavery in the city of New York, it's not plantation slavery, but it also can be very onerous. Not only did enslaved Africans build the infrastructure of the city, they actually changed the physical shape of Manhattan Island, expanding it east with landfill. They're clearing forests. They're building the roads, they're dredging the harbor, they're building the docks. One of the reasons for gradual emancipation is so that the slaveholders can work the enslaved Africans for the next 25 years, getting free labor from them. Essentially, gradual emancipation was a way of compensating slaveholders for the loss of their enslaved African property. However, enslaved Africans in New York were never compensated for hundreds of years of unpaid labor. A lot of the wealth that makes possible the growth and development of New York City in the 19th century is because of its complicity with slavery. Because of its location on the Gulf Stream, New York is the best port of call for the sale and the distribution of slave-produced commodities. Cotton from the South is put on coastal vessels and shipped to the Port of New York. Sugar from the Caribbean is put on coastal vessels and shipped to the Port of New York. Profits from sugar production, profits from cotton production, become the basis for the creation of Pennsylvania Railroad, the Long Island Railroad, AT&T. The main bank involved becomes the bank that becomes Citibank. While slavery ends, the racism of slavery continues. And that's what we see really continuing in the United States to this very day. During the New Deal, programs are created to help working people who have been badly injured by the Great Depression. Those programs often exclude African Americans. It carries over after World War II with the GI Bill. It guarantees veterans that they will have mortgage insurance, but they still must apply for the mortgages through local banks. Well, in the New York region, African Americans can't get mortgages to buy homes in many of these expanding suburbs. So what you created were virtually all white communities. In Manhattan, there is a program called Urban Renewal in the 50s and 60s, and it's a federal program. The African-American author James Baldwin, he cynically called Urban Renewal Negro Removal. But unfortunately, it continues to today. In communities in Brooklyn, in communities in Harlem, where you have gentrification, African Americans and now Latinos are being forced out of their own communities. So what you have is systematic racism creating the modern city. Education in the state of New York and in New York City, we see the shadow of slavery and the shadow of racism continuing to impact on people's lives. We have a problem in the United States today that more young black men are involved in the criminal justice system than get to go to college. So what we get is an educational system that holds people back, and then adding to that, people never catch up. It's like the gap becomes deeper and deeper financially the older they grow. That's why it's crucial that we understand the history of slavery, why we understand the history of racism, because it undermines our ability to deal with social inequality today.
Today, the generational impact of slavery, along with hundreds of years of discriminatory economic policies, can be seen clearly in the wealth gap between black and white families in America. Historical economists say home ownership, for example, became one of the most direct paths to wealth creation in America. But the cards were stacked against black homeowners. Decades after it was instituted, the government-sanctioned policy of redlining still to this day impacts black Americans. Thank you. Welcome back. When you ask yourself, what can I do? How can I make a difference? Maybe think of this next story. The Underground Railroad was a network of secret routes and safe houses established in the United States during the early to mid-19th century. These houses were instrumental, allowing 100,000 slaves seeking freedom to escape. So we want to end this show with a story about a building in Brooklyn, a home local New Yorkers, activists, and historians are trying to protect, a home which is believed to have been a stop on the Underground Railroad and is a positive reminder of New York's role in Black history.
New York was part of the Underground Railroad, and what does that mean? The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 meant that the federal government was now saying that it would support the return of any fugitive slaves that were found. People in New York who wanted to be a part of assisting these runaways, they would have, for example, their barns, a home, a farm, someone's house, where they would offer shelter to those who were on their way to a safer place.
Brooklyn was strong supporters of slavery, fervent supporters, to the point of being traitorous to the United States. We say, oh, okay, New York was on the good side, you know, the South was on the bad side. No, the majority of Brooklyn was pro-slavery, blatantly racist. It was economic ties and ideological ties.
New York, and Brooklyn in particular even, was a very important port in the export of the Southern slave-produced products. So though the South was the place that you had plantations and you had large numbers of enslaved people doing the agricultural work of picking cotton, baling cotton, many of the fortunes of the early Brooklyn industrialists and bankers came through the profits from the system of slavery.
A lot of our streets, a lot of our monuments, institutions are named after people who were slave owners, named after people who profited from slavery. I don't want to erase that history. That's part of our history too. But it only tells one side of the story.
This is what's happening. We have a home that was owned by prominent abolitionists that is set for demolition. And we have a way to save that home. 227 Duffield is a tangible, physical reminder of American history and of the part that was played by prominent people who were very courageous and put themselves on the line here in New York, in downtown Brooklyn, so that other people might literally be free.
The house next door to this home had a tunnel that connected both that house to this house. And we know that when authorities could knock on one door, then people were able to be smuggled into another home. And so that's why it's so significant that we keep this home.
It is the last of an entire area, an entire neighborhood of prominent abolitionists who were working to end slavery. And this is all we have.